final case this morning is Flores against Ashcroft. Mr. O'Connor. Okay, you can bring some water up if you want.
Thank you. I think I'll do that.
And I don't want to have you parched.
Good morning. This case involves a petition for review of a removal order issued by the Board of Immigration Appeals. The petitioner is a lawful permanent resident who was convicted of battery with injury under Indiana law, and the Immigration Service initiated removal proceedings alleging that he was convicted of a crime of violence and hence an aggravated felony. There's various issues that this case raises, but I'm going to concentrate primarily on the issue of crime of violence as well as the deprivation of the right to counsel by the immigration court.
If we were to find, though, that this, in fact, is a crime of violence and thus the statutory criteria are satisfied, why isn't the appeal over at that point? Why do we have jurisdiction to move on to the counsel issue?
Well, I believe the court does have jurisdiction to consider substantial constitutional issues, and I believe...
Is this a constitutional issue, though, or a statutory issue? Certainly there's a statutory right to counsel in INA cases, but where's the constitutional dimension?
The courts have held that there is a constitutional dimension to the right to counsel.
The constitutional dimension is that if the alien brings a lawyer, the INS can't throw him out. But there's no allegation that that took place.
Well, and also that the alien has to be provided with a reasonable opportunity to get a lawyer. And the waiver of the right, and this is where I think the immigration judge's primary violation was, is that the immigration judge has to satisfy himself that the alien has made efforts to determine whether there is cause to give more time and to take a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver of the right to counsel. So I think that is also a constitutional dimension to the claim.
Well, maybe we could focus on the crime of violence point, because...
Certainly. Similarly, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the nature of the finding of an aggravated felony. The courts have long recognized that a deportation order causes harsh consequences, and I think a deportation order based on the finding of an aggravated felony is qualitatively different than all other grounds of deportation. The only defense, if somebody is found to be convicted of an aggravated felony, the only remedy is an application for withholding of removal based on a likelihood of persecution. Anything else, there's no other remedy for anything else, regardless of the length of residence, the harsh consequences to family, or to the individual. There's no opportunity for any other waiver.
It seems to me your case has to turn on understanding Section 16A, which refers to an offense that has an element used to physical force in various ways. This qualifying adjective that you've argued in your brief, that the physical force has to be of some significance, has to be violent, has to be something. You know, if I reach over and pinched Judge Easterbrook, that would be, you know, it would be a battery and there would be injury and so forth, but he probably would survive.
That is correct, and I believe that would be clearly a battery under Indiana law. That
Indiana law
requires a touching in a rude, angry, or insolent manner, and certainly.
And it would be a part two. It would be the Class A misdemeanor kind, right? Because it yields physical injury.
Yes, physical injury, as far as Indiana has defined it, is really de minimis injury. It can be pain. It can be no pain and a slight scratch. So I think the government. As best as I can read the government's position, they're not really disputing that a simple battery would involve...
Right, but of course, his problem is that the not completely unreasonable inference that if you've been physically injured, physical force was used, was applied here, and you have to convince us somehow that this pushes the statute too far in terms of the aggravated felony
right.
requirement.
And I believe considering the nature of an aggravated felony, that has to be considered as part of the rule of lenity in immigration cases, that you can construe deportation statutes narrowly as possible. I think that's the first approach that the court should take to it, is that an aggravated felony is worse than any other deportation ground. I think that's an additional factor that should be considered in construing 16A.
But your problem is that the adjective isn't there in 16A. It just says the use, attempted use, or threatened use of physical force. And your opponents make the argument that if we had to get into the business of assessing every time, whether it was more like a pinch or a slap or, you know, breaking your arm or on and on, we'd have a very difficult job indeed.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the purpose of the federal authorities. The federal authorities have to look at the minimum conduct that would constitute a violation of the statute.
So in your view, where would that line be? How much force is enough to get over it? You could adopt a rule that it has to be at least 1,000 newtons? 2,000 newtons?
I think we have to...
Newton, by the way, in the event you don't know, is really a tiny amount of force.
And I was gonna raise the issue of Newton, because obviously when I've just moved the microphone a tiny bit, I've exercised some force on it.
You probably used at least 1,000 newtons.
Well, I'll defer the court's far greater expertise on the amount of force a Newton is. But I think what the federal authorities have to do is look at the way the state has defined the offense and what the state has found to be the minimum conduct. I don't think we are not here.
It's not what the state does that concerns us. This is a federal definition. It says use of force, and then we can decide whether the state statute falls within that federal definition. But you're saying that the federal definition has some minimum quantity requirement, that one newton is not enough, and 1,000 newtons probably aren't enough, and 10,000 newtons might be enough. And I'm wondering how we're going to draw that line.
Well, the courts have held...
Especially in a world where most lawyers don't understand what a Newton is. It turns out that some NASA engineers also don't understand what a Newton is, and that's why a probe burned up in Mars's atmosphere 4 years ago. We needn't worry about that.
Well, as a son of an engineer, I unfortunately do not understand what a Newton is. It's probably because of rebelliousness, but in any event, I think the courts have held that the force that's used has to be force that is violent in nature. And then you look to see whether the state offense requires conduct which is violent in nature. And I think that is the limit of the inquiry. And I think very clearly Indiana does not require force which is violent in nature. I think this court has held, for example, that touchings of a sexual nature, when there's no compulsion, where it's just somebody reaches over and pinches another person in a sexually intimate place, does not involve violence. And I think clearly that would be a violation of Indiana's battery statute. So we have some precedent in the federal system of what is and what isn't violence, and a sexual touching where somebody just reaches over and touches another person inappropriately is not the use of violent force. And I think very clearly that would be a violation of Indiana statute. So the minimum conduct to get a violation of Indiana statute is very minimal conduct. So I don't know that we have to have an exact line drawn here, but we do know that Indiana would cover conduct which the courts have already held does not involve the use of violence, the use of force as defined in 16A. In addition, the injury element, as I mentioned, I believe that's really a red herring. The Indiana has injury in Indiana is almost nothing at all. And you could presumably get, I acknowledge most of the time, or often at least, injury will be the result of violent force, but it's not required by Indiana law.
So you're not arguing, just say for some sort of de minimis factor, that if the statute permits a conviction, even for, you know, the amount of force you applied to that microphone a minute ago, which I suppose is discernible, though it'd be pretty hard to say a person, that's why I wanted to go up to a pinch. You know, a pinch at least smarts for a half a second. But you wouldn't say that somehow de minimis harm isn't under the statute. Is there Indiana case law that suggests how low you can go before you don't get a conviction?
There is case law that shows how low you can go and get a conviction. And that is where the victim testifies that he or she suffered pain, even though there's no objective manifestations of injury, or when the victim, even when the victim said, it didn't hurt me, but there was a scratch that was visible. And Indiana is allowed a conviction in those circumstances to be injury, to be...
It creates the horrifying prospect of writing a dirty phrase on a piece of paper, folding it up into a paper airplane, throwing it and causing a paper cut.
Right.
And leading to a conviction under this
removed from the United States on the
exactly.
basis of that.
And I think one of the examples I cited in the brief was
I read the briefs in this case, I have ceased throwing paper airplanes.
At least in Indiana.
Right.
If the court has no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Poacher.
May it please the court, my name is Aviva Poxter for the government. In this case, petitioner's conviction for a crime of violence, an aggravated felony, bars this court's ultimate jurisdiction over his petition for review, although of course you have jurisdiction to establish your jurisdiction.
Is it your view that any amount of force, however slight, creates a crime of violence? Take my hypothetical, right? I do something in an angry manner. I write down on a piece of paper, an insulting word, and throw it, and the piece of paper hits the person. A number of newtons are inflicted and causes a paper cut.
Well,
is that the application of physical force against the person of another?
For practical purposes, Your Honor, the Immigration and Nationality Act, which is, again, the statute that is ultimately in question in here, in this case, and the board's application of that case, does not make distinctions regarding the amount of physical force necessary.
So your answer is any discernible force, one newton, is enough.
If you can get a conviction for that, then, and if that conviction falls under the crime of violence definition provided by
that's
Congress,
the question,
then
whether it falls under the crime of violence definition. That's what we're trying to figure out. Let me give you another hypothetical. Somebody finds a set of car keys on the street. A person has dropped the car keys next to the car. He picks up the car keys, puts the key in the lock, turns the key, opens the door, puts the key in the ignition, turns it, and drives away. He's stolen the car. Obviously a felony under state law. Now, anybody who understands physics would say that force has been applied when the key was turned. Probably several thousand newtons were applied. Is that a crime of violence, as you understand it?
Potentially, if the court determined that it was, then
no,
yes.
We're the court. If we determine it was, then it was, I suppose. What,
yes.
What rule should we apply in making that determination?
Well, if there's some question, again, about the interpretation of a criminal statute, this court, in assessing the crime of violence definition, uses generally two different types of approaches. The first is a categorical approach, in which this court asks whether the generic elements of the crime of the state conviction taken together with the indictment constitute a crime of violence. If that is not acceptable, then the court can look to the charging documents to the aliens for civil conduct.
You're just completely going by the question. There is a word in the statute. The word is force. We're trying to figure out the meaning of the word, or perhaps more accurately, the interpolation before it. We could interpolate before that word the word any, or some, or a lot, or violent. I mean, the question I was asking your adversary, we could interpolate 1,000 newtons, 50,000 newtons. There is going to be some word implied in front of force. And we're trying to figure, and this is a legal question, what word goes in front of the word force in that statute, and why?
Well, again, in this case, the petitioner punched his wife in the face.
No, but that's not...
That is irrelevant. We're trying to figure out what word goes in front of the word force in the federal statute.
Well, if this statute is taken as you know, read on its face, then yes, any use of force.
So the property of the car has been taken with the use of force in Judge Easterbrook's hypothetical?
I think you have to answer yes.
I suppose so, yes.
You have to answer
yes. You have
yes.
to say my paper airplane case is a crime of violence under the statute.
Notwithstanding that the Supreme Court has a number of cases that suggest, you know, certain kinds of burglary where there is force in the Newtonian sense, but not in, let's say, the street sense, aren't crimes of violence.
Right.
And they pose no risk to people in the vicinity. So, you know, this statute, of course, the immigration laws incorporate by reference 18 U.S.C. Section 16, and we're dealing with 16A, of course, because this man was only convicted of a misdemeanor, so 16B does not apply. 16B only talks about any other offense that is a felony, so that's out. So we're just looking at attempted use, or threatened use of physical force against the person or property of another. And if a paper cut or a pinch or, you know, even, I suppose, a tiny push with the finger that creates some subsurface breaking of a capillary is this kind of force, then that's a very broad statute and lots of reasons why you might remove people from the country. But we have to decide what we really have here, because the Indiana statute, it appears, does encompass all of those hypotheticals. Mm-hmm. I think it certainly encompasses the paper cut.
Oh, the paper airplane is clearly within the Indiana statute.
Yeah, easily. So the petition
if it's got angry or insulting words on it.
Yes, right, that's true.
But the problem here is being convicted of a crime of violence. Now, a lot of these hypotheticals are sort of silly. Nobody's going to be charged and convicted in an Indiana court of writing a nasty note and crumpling it up and throwing it at somebody.
Actually, one of the Indiana cases involved a spitball.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Conviction for throwing a spitball.
They're jealous in Indiana.
They really protect people's bodily integrity in Indiana.
Well, spousal abuse is a very serious thing, and many spousal abuse cases are turned away by prosecutors. So why can't we assume here a conviction in an Indiana court of law of a spousal abuse charge as a crime of violence or use of force, however that may be construed or interpreted?
Well, I think that definitely the fact that in this case petitioner's spouse notified the authorities is definitely and went through with this, I assume she was somehow involved in the criminal proceedings below, does indicate that it was a fairly serious conviction. I mean, realistically, we're not talking about someone who threw a paper airplane at his wife and somehow got convicted in Indiana for undertaking that type of act. He used violent force against his wife and was convicted for that action. And under the Immigration and Nationality Act, the fact that he undertook or committed this crime against a protected person, yes, is enough to get a conviction, and the court certainly can find him removable on that background alone.
How deeply are you arguing we should look into the factual background of the conviction? Because I certainly agree with you, if we're going to look at everything, first of all, you find out that this lady is his wife, and you find out what he did.
Well, we would suggest that since there is a certain wide threshold that the Indiana statute will cover for this type of conviction, you should look to the underlying criminal documents in this case and find that, taken as a totality, he definitely committed a crime of violence against his wife and therefore an aggravated felony. And that's for what he was convicted.
Is there any reason to take a different approach in immigration cases to this kind of investigation of the record than we do, for example, in sentencing guidelines cases like our in-bank case in the United States against Shannon?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I would submit that there is, because what we're ultimately dealing with is a civil proceeding. And the immigration proceedings are not bound by the federal rules of evidence. And don't require the same type of evidentiary standards that are required in a criminal-type proceeding.
But, of course, one of the purposes of the Shannon rule is to avoid having a whole series of mini-trials inside, you know, what did he really do, and then off you are on sidelight number one and sidelight number two. Wouldn't that apply equally to immigration or civil or other proceedings?
Well, immigration judges and the board are not allowed to look behind the record of conviction. However, the conviction documents, the criminal documents in this case, are sufficient on their face to elaborate enough of the crime to determine what he did and that it was a crime of violence.
And by what specifically do you mean the conviction documents? What documents do you think are permissible to consult?
Usually the indictment is consulted. The court's ultimate ruling in the case is consulted. Pre-sentencing reports have been consulted. Those types of documents. Police reports have been consulted as well.
Pretty broad, yeah.
Yes. And again, I'd just like to emphasize that in this case there was a physical injury to his wife, and the statutory section under which he was convicted does require a physical injury. And realistically, again, he most likely would not have been convicted for a bruise or a minor physical injury. He was convicted for a serious offense taken against his spouse. In terms of petitioner's purportedly constitutional arguments, I'd just like to point out that this court reviews only substantial constitutional claims that review in and of itself is an extraordinary procedure and a safety. It has been called a safety valve by this court.
I don't understand any of that after Calcano Martinez against the INS. There might be some opportunity for habeas corpus under St. Cyr, but after Calcano Martinez, I think we're under instructions just to apply the review preclusion statute as it's written and not make exceptions.
Well, this court's case law has said that
preceding Calcano Martinez, but of course one of the keystones of that was expressly disapproved in St. Cyr by the Supreme Court.
Well, again, if this court does decide to reach that issue, we would say that immigration court proceedings, again, are civil in nature, and aliens have no Sixth Amendment right to counsel. In this case, petitioner, in fact, did obtain counsel who was provided with
By the way, I guess I should have asked Mr. O'Connor, but I can't figure out what any of this has to do with anything. Is there any argument that had a lawyer been present earlier, he would have shown that, the person on this record of conviction was not Mr. Flores?
Other
than that, there's nothing going on in this case.
Well, wouldn't a lawyer have made the legal argument that we're now being asked to address about aggravated felony,
right,
which presumably, if made at a timely manner before the immigration judge, would at least have been listened to, perhaps, perhaps persuasively?
Well, the counsel below basically wanted to withdraw petitioner's plea to his notice to appear.
Right. He didn't get a lawyer at the time it really mattered. The only time the lawyer was there was later on when he still had an opportunity to apply for asylum, which he chose eventually not to do. But it's a little disingenuous of the government to say, oh, he had a lawyer, when in fact the whole ball game was done from his point of view, aside from this little thread of an asylum possibility without a lawyer.
Well, in fact, his lawyer was allowed by the immigration judge to present pleadings related to his removability charge.
Right, and then the immigration judge said, I'm not going to give you two bites at the apple, you're too late. So that's not really the same as a timely presentation by the lawyer.
It would have perhaps been better for him to obtain a lawyer earlier, but it's his burden to, again, it's his burden to do so, and he didn't do so.
Right, he only had 2 weeks to do it, and he was a long way from home and incarcerated, so logistically, that's a rather short period of time to work one's way through the system. A lot of cases say 6 months is plenty of time, 4 months is plenty of time, 2 weeks is a little brisk.
Well, Your Honor, actually, he was served with a notice to appear, which indicated that he would have immigration court proceedings over 2 months before his first set of proceedings. Accordingly, he had time, more than 2 weeks, to get a lawyer. And he didn't make
his initial efforts have been unsuccessful, though, as he reported to the immigration judge. He couldn't find people except the person who wanted $3,000, and he was trying to get through to the legal service organizations and hadn't had time to do it yet.
He did say that, but he was given continuances for the...
One continuance of 2 weeks.
For the purposes of obtaining counsel, but he could have at any time obtained counsel, and he was told that he had a right to obtain counsel. In addition, his counsel did provide pleadings to the immigration judge, which the immigration judge told him on the record he was considering before making his final decision.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. O'Connor?
First, I believe the court's hypothetical on finding the car keys and using them to open the car, I think that clearly has been found in this court, as well as the Ninth Circuit, not to constitute an aggravated felony with sufficient force. Solorzano Patlan found that in this court, and I believe Yee versus INS found that. The government's assertion that any use of force would be sufficient to violate 16A, I think, again, that's not the law in this court, and in fact, it's not even the law before the BIA. In matter of Small, which is one of the cases I cited in the supplemental citation, the BIA held that the sex offense involved in that case, which involved a touching, an offensive touching, was not the use of force. Destructive force, I believe, is the term that the BIA used in that case, under 16A. Now, they did find it to be a sexual abuse of a minor aggravated felony, but they did not find it to be an aggravated felony as a crime of violence under 16A. I think that, as Judge Evans mentioned, that nobody would be convicted of throwing a spitwad. I'm not certain that's the case. At least in Florida, there is a case where somebody was convicted of throwing a ravioli and going into a food fight. So, and the Florida statute is written very similarly to the Indiana statute. Now, the Court of Appeals in that case...
I hope it was John Belushi.
The Court of Appeals in that case said, when are you bringing this case forward? But we don't have any authority to stop the prosecutor from doing that. So it is indeed very possible. It's probably not the most common type of battery charge, but it does happen. In addition, I don't think any inferences can be drawn from the sentence that was imposed, because and I'm no expert on criminal law, but I, as an immigration practitioner, I do see a fair amount of criminal convictions as they relate to immigration consequences, and it seems that a lot of Indiana judges will impose a long sentence and then suspend the vast majority of it. So, but for purposes of determining a crime of violence, we look at the sentence imposed, not the time actually served. So again, the fact that it was a year sentence doesn't necessarily mean that it was a heinous crime. The government keeps talking about the factual background. I don't think it's appropriate to look at the record of a conviction in this case, which is not nearly as broad as including police reports. The issue in this case is the elements of the offense. It's not a deportation for violent conduct. It's a deportation for a crime that is violent. So and 16A directly says, look at the elements of the offense. Now, the only exception to that is when the court can look at the conviction record is when the offense is considered divisible. And that is when the statute articulates certain conduct that clearly is violent in nature or involves moral turpitude or whatever the immigration hook is, and other conduct which does not necessarily violate, invoke immigration consequences. That's the only purpose, so that when the court can determine whether it was an offense that was violent or not. For example, if the Indiana statute said something like, it is unlawful to touch someone with the intent to inflict injury, which the BIA has held that is a crime of violence, or to touch somebody in a rude, angry, insolent manner, in that case we could look at the record of conviction, but only to determine whether he was convicted under the first part of the statute or the second part of the statute. In any every other circumstance, that you only look at the crime as defined and only the minimum conduct that the crime that is required to sustain a conviction. Just lastly, in this case, the alien was not served with a notice to appear 2 months before. The administrative record, page 194, indicates that the service was on August 24th, so that was only a month before. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Connor. The case is taken under advisement.